Merci bien, Henri, pour cette introduction. Thank you very much. Je m'excuse pour parler en anglais. J'aurais pu parler en français, mais dans un français pas tellement correct, donc j'ai choisi de parler en anglais. Je m'excuse encore une fois, mais je peux prendre les questions après en français si vous voulez.
I gave as a title to my friend and colleague, Henri Laurence, the title, Three Moments, the United States and the Palestinians. And that is going to be the general topic of my four lectures. As I have been working on them, however, I have developed a different working title. And that, I think, helps you to understand where I will be going with these four lectures. The working title is Dishonest Broker, or Israel's Lawyer. I'm deliberating on which of those two I will give to the final version of these lectures. And today I'm going to give you an introduction in which I lay out what I will be saying in all four lectures and provide, I think, the necessary background for understanding the relationship between the United States and the Palestinians and the Palestine question. I begin with a few words from George Orwell. In Politics and the English Language, in 1946, Orwell wrote the following. The slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. If thought corrupts language, language can also corrupt thought. A bad usage can spread by tradition and imitation, even among people who should and do know better. Those are not my words. Those are George Orwell's words. In politics and in diplomacy, as in everything else, language matters greatly. However debased political discourse may be, however disingenuous diplomats often are, the words employed by politicians and diplomats define, limit, and often determine outcomes. In recent history, few semantic battles over and struggles over terminology have been as intensely fought out as those over Palestine and Israel. This can be illustrated by the common usage and the powerful valence in the Middle Eastern context of terms such as terrorism, self-determination, autonomy, honest broker, and peace process. Each of these terms has defined and determined not only perceptions, but often what in the end can and cannot be done by the parties involved. In some cases, and I will be arguing this throughout my four lectures, in some cases, and in these cases in particular, dead, wooden, corrupted language can profoundly obscure reality. This has frequently been the case, in particular, where the Palestinians and Palestine are concerned. In Palestine, very early, a decisive, discursive hegemony established at the very beginnings of the conflict by the Zionist movement has significantly reinforced the power balance in its favor, and later in favor, after 1948, in favor of the State of Israel. This has placed the Palestinians at a constant disadvantage, not starting in the 50s or the 60s, starting in the early decades of the 20th century, as they are forced to compete within a field whose terms are defined by their opponents. As Edward Said aptly put it, and I'm quoting Edward Said now, it is by no means an exaggeration to say that the establishment of Israel as a state in 1948 occurred partly because the Zionists acquired control of most of the territory of Palestine, and partly because they had already won the political battle for Palestine in the international world in which ideas, representation, rhetoric, and images were at issue. What follows in all four of these lectures, really, is an attempt to pierce one aspect of a carefully constructed realm of obscurity and distortion, of the dead wooden language that Orwell was referring to. It will do so, or I will try to do so, by focusing on three sets of events, the three moments of my title, which I will treat in my second, third, and fourth lectures. I'm arguing that these three moments constituted instance of clarity over a period of more than 35 years. They're snapshots at crucial junctures when unusual circumstances drew back the veil on underlying realities. Now, let me be clear. What is being concealed by this veil, by this curtain, are not primarily basic verities about the situation in Palestine per se. That is also concealed. That is also behind a veil. What I will be talking about is another veil. I will be talking about how the veil that conceals how the policy of the United States towards the Palestine question has actually functioned over this period of about 30 or 35 years that I'm going to take for my four lectures. My objective is first to reveal how closely linked, in detail, have been the policies of the United States and Israel towards the Palestine question and towards the Palestinians. My second objective will be to examine how constant and unchanging have been the key elements in these politics over many decades. When I began to prepare for these lectures, I assumed that having been writing about this topic since the early 1970s and having lived it in a certain measure over that period, I had a very good sense of how close American and Israeli policies were. And I thought I had a very good sense of how constant American policy has been over this period. In looking carefully at the documents that I have assembled and will discuss in my lectures, I realized that I had no idea. And that, in fact, as we'll see, I hope, in the next three lectures, these policies were much more close together and much more unchanging than I had any idea of. My third objective is to show, is to use these three revealing sets of events to show how the existing enduring system of control over the Palestinians under occupation was conceived, constructed, and maintained by Israel with the acquiescence and support of the United States and sometimes of other powers, European powers, Arab powers like Egypt and others. The existence of this almost invisible system, now you may say the system of occupation is invisible. In fact, it is almost invisible. It's not a topic of my lecture, but it is a topic worthy of discussion. The existence of this almost invisible system in turn explains in large part why the Palestinians have not been able to achieve their national objectives of liberation from occupation, unifying the sundered and scattered segments of the Palestinian people, and obtaining self-determination, and why, therefore, their situation as a people remains so intractable. Now, I would argue that examining how these objectives were achieved in these three instances, the three moments that I will discuss, will finally provide insight into the real reasons why a just, lasting, and comprehensive peace based on a satisfactory resolution of the problem of Palestine has not emerged over these 35 years. You are all aware that there is no such peace. There is no resolution. We have not come anywhere near a resolution of this conflict. This is the case in spite of decades of futile initiatives that were ostensibly directed at achieving peace between Palestinians and Israelis under what I would describe as an Orwellian rubric of a peace process. Looked at objectively, it's apparent, at least to me, that these efforts have, if anything, made achieving peace between Palestinians and Israelis even more difficult than they were in the 1960s or 70s. These efforts go back to the U.S.-brokered 1978 Camp David Accords between Egypt and Israel, which constituted the first American attempt after the 1967 war to address the Palestinian-Israeli aspect of the larger Arab-Israeli dispute. The United States really never dealt with the Palestine question on a political level before Camp David, with the exception of minor efforts in the early 50s. These efforts encompass as well the initiatives of Presidents Carter, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, the first, Clinton, George W. Bush, the second, and the Obama administration, finally. In my text, I'm reading it to you, but in my text, I place the ubiquitous term peace process in quotation marks. Because whatever effects this process may have had, whether it was a process that, as I would argue, consecrated what amounts to a colonial status quo in Palestine, or whether it actually exacerbated that status quo, and whether this process has improved the position of the United States in the Middle East or has harmed it, it is clear, again, to me at least, that it has certainly not brought peace to these two peoples or resolved the conflict between them. So whatever it is not a peace process. It is not a process that has brought peace. And I will argue in my lectures, it was not a process that in fact was intended to bring peace between Palestinians and Israelis. And I'll explain that later. Let me talk about the three moments that will be the subjects of my subsequent lectures. The first of these three moments of clarity came in the late summer of 1982, after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, when it briefly appeared to American policymakers as if there might be an opportunity to put into force the hitherto unimplemented provisions of the 1978 Camp David Accords relating to Palestinian autonomy. As you may remember, these accords, which were incorporated into the 1979 peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, were the most serious American effort since the Eisenhower administration to address the question of Palestine and the Palestinians, and they were the first to address certain political aspects political dimensions of this question. However, Israel, Egypt, and the United States had been unable to agree on the interpretation of key provisions of the accords during a long series of follow-up negotiations, which is why what happens in 1982 is important. The accords were signed in 1978. Nothing happened. The Israelis and Egyptians negotiated for 3.5 years with no implementation. So with the Reagan plan, which I'll talk about, the United States thought finally that there was a chance for implementation of these accords. So in 1982, American policymakers saw an opportunity to address this impasse in the wake of the summer-long Israeli siege and bombardment of West Beirut and in anticipation of the evacuation of the leadership, the civilian cadres, and the military forces of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, from Beirut. As you may remember, this took place at the end of August of 1982. Washington viewed this dramatic change affecting the entire region as reinforcing the American position in the Middle East. It was thus considered by policymakers in Washington as the appropriate occasion for the release of a U.S. proposal, which later came to be known as the Reagan Plan, which was announced publicly on television by President Ronald Reagan on September 1st, 1982. Particularly revealing in this regard were perspicacious, very perceptive, confidential American intelligence assessments of how inflexible would be the reaction of Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin to this plan. These are never before published, only recently discovered American documents about the Reagan plan, which in fact one of my students stumbled upon in the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. They predicted, these American intelligence analysts, that Prime Minister Begin would refuse to budge from his narrow, reductive interpretation of the autonomy accords, that he would not make any compromises and would not come any closer to the position that Reagan would lay out. Equally revealing was the eventual unwillingness or inability of the Reagan administration to overcome Begin's objections and to hold firm to the positions publicly enunciated by the president. And I'll be talking about this mainly in my second lecture, the episode around 1982, where the United States tried to put into effect the solemn obligations of Israel and Egypt and the United States vis-a-vis Palestinian autonomy. So that's the first moment, the first set of events I want to talk about. The second set of events occurred during nearly 2 years of bilateral negotiations between Israeli and Palestinian delegations in Washington that followed the October 1991 Madrid Peace Conference. These talks were ultimately rendered moot by the secretly negotiated Oslo Accords that were later signed on the White House lawn in September 1993 by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, and US President Bill Clinton. Nevertheless, the confidential documents and the public statements that the Washington negotiations produced, to which I had privileged access as an advisor to the Palestinian delegation, These documents reveal much about a fundamental American and Israeli positions, and especially about the high degree of overlap between them. Let me say that what you will be hearing in my discussion of this second moment will be my views, my ideas, but entirely based on documentation which I obtained during my 2.5 years, or almost 3 years, of involvement in these negotiations. These are never before published. These are documents that were only really available to the participants in the events. And this is one of the sets of materials that I've used for these lectures, which, in fact, convinced me of things that I had not myself realized. Most striking in looking at these documents carefully, minutes of meetings, position papers produced by the Palestinian side, Israeli proposals, public and other private documents. Most striking in this documentation was the unmistakable continuity of the restrictive Israeli position on Israeli autonomy, which I found was essentially unchanged from the time of Begin through the governments of Yitzhak Shamir and Yitzhak Rabin. Equally striking was the gradual, in fact not so gradual, acquiescence of American policy in this position. So what I'm saying is that what Begin put forward as his position in 1978, what the Americans were not able to change in 1982, was the basis of the position put forward by Yitzhak Shamir in 1991, and was not substantially changed after he came to power by Yitzhak Rabin in 1992, and as we'll see, was the basis of the Oslo Accords, is the basis of the existing regime in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem today. I'll come to that in my discussion of these things later on. As little noticed as these things that I've just mentioned in the euphoria over the signing of the Oslo Accords was the unreliability of the American commitments made to the Palestinians at the outset of the Madrid talks. The United States offered the Palestinians what was called a letter of assurances. Every party to the Madrid conference obtained a similar letter of assurance. Israel obtained several because it was negotiating on four different fronts. Jordan obtained a letter of assurances. The Palestinians obtained one. The Syrians obtained one. The Lebanese obtained one. The United States issued these as guides to what American policy would be and guides to what the various parties could expect during the Madrid and later on Washington negotiations. And what is quite striking to me and was striking to us at the time was that the United States was not faithful to the commitments it made in these letters of assurances, at least to the Palestinians. And I make a parallel here between commitments that the United States made to the PLO in 1982 at the time of the evacuation of Palestinian forces from Beirut, which I will talk about next week. One can contrast the unreliability of American commitments to the Palestinians at the beginning of the Madrid talks with the faithfulness of Washington to its pledges to Israel, both in its letter of assurances of 1991 and earlier and later pledges to Israel, and the United States' responsiveness to Israeli demands. So that's the second moment, the 1991-93 negotiations. The third moment emerged during the Obama administration's third year in office, that is to say the past year or so. Over this period, President Barack Obama was forced by relentless pressure from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was acting in collusion with the Republican leadership in Congress, which was newly energized after its victories in the 2010 midterm elections, and in coordination with the Israeli lobby, he was forced by this concatenation of forces, Netanyahu, the Republicans, the Israel lobby, into humiliating retreats from the outspoken positions that the president had staked out during his first 2 years in office, between his election in 2008 and the election of a Republican majority in 2010. These positions that the president initially took included his assertion of the necessity for the rapid achievement of statehood by the Palestinians, his stress on halting the expansion of Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank as a precondition for the continuation of Palestinian-Israeli negotiations, and his insistence that a return to the 1967 armistice lines, the 1967 frontiers, with minor modifications as per UN Security Council Resolution 242, was the only suitable basis for negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. The president took all of these positions in his first 2 years. He retreated from them in his third year in office. The embarrassing abandonment of all these positions culminated in the fall of last year, in the fall of 2011, in a major campaign by the United States to obstruct a Palestinian bid for recognition of a Palestinian state as a full member of the United Nations. In this context, President Obama, in October of 2011, delivered perhaps the most pro-Israel speech by any US president ever to the UN General Assembly. Now, those are the three moments. Careful examination of newly declassified US government records, of public statements, and of confidential documents that I was privy to that were produced before, during, and after the 1993 Madrid and Washington negotiations, and also of actions taken by the American and Israeli governments in these instances over 35 years, provides us, I think, with a very clear sense of the long-term core policies of both states. These policies are thoroughly, and in some cases intentionally, obfuscated and distorted in much of the superficial writing on the subject, including writing by people who should know better. Since the Camp David Accords in 1978, and especially since the Madrid Peace Conference in 1991, the incessant American mantra, whether in official statements or in writing by people who are policy-oriented or by academics or by journalists, about a so-called peace process has served to disguise an ugly reality. This is the fact, as I've already said, that whatever process the United States was championing, in fact, it was not actually directed at achieving a just and lasting peace between Palestinians and Israelis. Let me say parenthetically that a real peace, a real just and lasting peace between equals, would necessarily have involved a rapid and complete end to the Israeli military occupation and colonization of Palestinian land in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It would necessarily have involved self-determination for the Palestinians in some form. It necessarily would have involved a just resolution for the Palestinian refugees who were made homeless by the establishment of Israel in 1948 and by its further expansion in 1967. If seriously undertaken at any stage over the past 4.5 decades, such a process would, by now, have long since resulted in Palestinian sovereignty and statehood and in a resolution of the problem. Instead of actually trying to achieve these things or anything like them, it appears clear to me that, as far as the United States was concerned, the process was actually aimed primarily at pressuring the weaker Palestinians into conforming to the desiderata of a much stronger Israel. An Israel which was intent on maintaining permanent, effective control of all or most of the West Bank and all of East Jerusalem, and which was firmly opposed to the Palestinians achieving any of their national objectives. The subsidiary American objective, in reality, often seems to have been to avoid lasting differences between the United States and its powerful and inflexible Israeli ally. Such differences were seen as highly undesirable by administration after administration for reasons that ranged from domestic politics to strategic considerations. What the United States therefore ended up doing over several decades was actually conflict management and conflict perpetuation rather than conflict resolution or bringing about real peace. Now, while my four lectures will focus closely on these three episodes I've mentioned over the past 35 years of a so-called peace process, in fact, the core dynamics at work in American policymaking where Palestine is concerned, domestic politics and occasionally strategic considerations, have been remarkably stable for over 60 years, going back to the Second World War. And today I'm going to conclude my lecture by outlining the basic lineaments of this process in a brief examination of one of the earliest phases of American involvement in the question of Palestine under President Harry Truman from 1945 to 1948. And I apologize for taking you back to the 1940s. I know it's a very long time ago. But in fact, I think you'll see that plus ça change, plus ça reste même chose. Certain things have really not changed. And this will be sort of the anchor for the three moments that I will talk about in the further lectures that I'll be giving. American politicians had shown strong sympathy to the Zionist movement from the time of President Woodrow Wilson onwards. I'm not going to take you back to Wilson. Don't worry. However, this had little impact on events on the ground in Palestine before World War II because of the relatively low profile of the United States in the Middle East until that point. The American profile began to rise, however, with the massive American military presence in the region from North Africa to Iran that was produced by World War II. Meanwhile, the vast strategic importance of Saudi Arabia ensured that President Franklin Roosevelt took pains to meet personally with King Abdulaziz ibn Saud while the president was passing through Egypt on his way back to the United States from Yalta in March 1945. Saudi Arabia, which had an exclusive deal with American oil companies for exploitation and exploration dating back to 1933, had by 1945 been found to contain the world's largest reservoir of proven oil reserves, and it still contains the world's largest reservoir of proven oil reserves. Meanwhile, developments during World War II had decisively proven the role of oil in fueling or hindering attempts to achieve global mastery. Indeed, a State Department report in 1945 noted, quote, that Saudi oil resources constitute a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. This is a State Department report, 1945. During their meeting in March 1945 on the deck of a U.S. warship, which took place only a few weeks before President Roosevelt's death, the Saudi monarch stressed to the president the importance of Palestine to him personally and to the Arabs generally. He received a promise from Roosevelt, later set down in a letter, to the effect that the United States would not act in Palestine in any way that would harm the Arabs of that country or without consulting the Arab states. So the president promised two things. He would do nothing that would harm the Arabs in Palestine, and he would do nothing without consulting with the Arab states. I cannot stress enough that had this pledge been scrupulously respected by subsequent US presidents, events in Palestine might have transpired very differently. Now, Roosevelt's death brought to the office of president of the most powerful country in human history a man who had relatively limited experience of the world. Harry Truman had served in combat in France as an artillery officer during World War I, but his career thereafter as a farmer, as a clothing salesman, and in politics had poorly prepared him for some of the duties he would face. He had little sense, for example, of the strategic sense of oil, unlike Roosevelt, who had served as Assistant Secretary of the Navy during World War I, when the US fleet shifted to oil and the United States became dependent on oil for its strategic reach. So Roosevelt, for decades, had understood oil. Truman really didn't. And it was, in fact, Roosevelt who had approved an order to the US Army Air Force in 1943 to focus its strategic bombing effort on German oil resources. Roosevelt understood these things. Truman, however, was a canny and experienced politician. He was a man with a clear understanding of what it took to help his party's chances in elections, and he was focused from the moment he came into office on the 1946 midterm elections that were coming up. He came into office in April 1945. He had a year and a half before the midterm elections, and on his re-election as president in 1948. And in fact, he succeeded against all odds in being re-elected in November 1948. Where Palestine was concerned, Truman demonstrated his acute political instincts from the very outset of his presidency. He strongly supported the pressure that the Zionist movement was placing on Britain over Jewish immigration to Palestine, and on other issues that were of deep concern to American Zionists and to a broad section of the president's liberal political base. Truman had initially denied, speaking to State Department officials, that President Roosevelt had made any wartime promises at all to Ibn Saud. He only grudgingly accepted that this was the case when the State Department produced for him the relevant correspondence between the president and Ibn Saud. But in his policy on Palestine thereafter, Truman resolutely ignored these pledges, as he ignored the advice of the State Department, of the Pentagon, and of the US intelligence services. Instead, he did only what his instincts told him was politic in American domestic terms. Thus, while he was meeting with four American diplomats who were serving in Arab capitals in November of 1945, before the 1945 elections, Truman responded to their concerns There were elections only in a few areas in 1945. It was an off-year election, but it was important, and I'll talk about why in a minute. Truman responded to these four senior American diplomats who had expressed their concern regarding American policy over Palestine by saying, and now I quote the president, "I'm sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." The president frankly told the four envoys that the question of Zionism, political Zionism, and I quote again, was a burning issue in the domestic politics of the United States. This is 1945. And he added that it had caused him and Secretary of State James Burns, again I quote the president, more trouble than almost any other question which is facing the United States. In 1945, the president said that Palestine was causing him and the Secretary of State, I quote, more trouble than almost any other question which is facing the United States. Truman had kept these four senior diplomats, the chiefs of legations in Jeddah, Cairo, Damascus, and Baghdad, who had been called back specially from the Middle East by the State Department, specifically to meet the president. He kept them waiting for weeks before he would see them on the advice of his closest advisors. One of these advisors, James Burns, who was the Secretary of State, noted, quote, "If the president should see them, it is certain that the newspapers would suspect that the conversations were being held here as a result of the promise to Ibn Saud as to consultation. Certainly, the president is not going to see them before November 6, which was election day, and I think it would be equally unwise for me to do so." In other words, they were afraid to meet American diplomats posted in the Middle East before election day. Burns and the president's other counselors had felt that a meeting with envoys to Arab countries might harm the Democratic Party's chances in what was expected to be a hotly contested 1945 mayoral election in New York City. Election for mayor of New York City was more important to the president and the secretary of state than meeting his four envoys. They were, I think, also concerned about the 1946 midterms, which were a year away at this point, and I think the president was also probably thinking of his own reelection because he concurred with the advice of his advisors. In the event, although the Democrats won the 1946 mayoral election, 1945 mayoral election in New York, they lost the 46 midterms, losing control of the House in the biggest congressional defeat suffered by the Democratic Party since 1928. Presciently, Truman concluded his meeting with his four diplomats by saying to them, quote, "Palestine would probably be an issue during the election campaign of 1946 and 1948 and in future campaigns." He was certainly right about that. The 1946 electoral defeat in the House did not affect Truman's favoring of domestic political calculations over those of strategy and the national interest where Palestine was concerned. Truman was the last American president without a college education, a university education. He was a plain-spoken, self-made man who resented the way well-bred Ivy League State Department personnel looked down on him. Unlike many diplomats, some of whom shared the casual anti-Semitism of their moneyed peers, Truman also felt keenly the moral imperative of saving European Jews who had survived the Holocaust. This was the case, although in earlier years, neither he nor most American politicians, from President Roosevelt on down, had lifted a finger to save those Jews who could have been saved before they were murdered by the Nazis. This can be explained by the weight of American anti-Semitism in the 1930s and early 1940s, which meant that it was simply not politic to favor massive Jewish immigration to the United States. All the people who were in Germany and were threatened by Nazi anti-Jewish laws could have been saved had the doors of immigration been opened to the United States. Before 1941-42, the Nazis had not decided to exterminate the entire Jewish population of Europe. They would have let them go had there been a place for them to go. The United States would not let them in because, as I've said, it was simply not politic to favor massive Jewish immigration to the United States. However, after World War II, and particularly after revelation of the horror of the Nazi death camps, there was no political cost and much benefit to calling for the surviving Jewish residents of what were then called the DP camps, the displaced person camps, to be sent elsewhere, specifically to Palestine, and to obtain a state of their own there. Truman was always strongly influenced by a coterie of advisors and friends like Eleanor Roosevelt, the widow of the previous president, and Clark Clifford, who later on became Secretary of State, who included many committed Zionists. In addition, he tended to listen most carefully to those like himself, whose political lives had been primarily spent making domestic and electoral calculations rather than decisions about strategy or foreign policy or the national interest. It's not a coincidence that he would put someone like Burns in as Secretary of State. Burns had served years and years in the Senate, years and years in the House, a couple of years on the Supreme Court. He was a master politician. He was the kind of person that Truman felt comfortable with. A very smart fellow, but not a very worldly Secretary of State. The results, as we all know, in 1948 were overdetermined. Truman, supported by the strong pro-Zionist sentiments of a set of core Democratic constituencies, basically imposed support for Jewish statehood in Palestine in 1947-48 on a reluctant Washington bureaucracy. The government didn't want to do this. The president made them do it. He did so notwithstanding the warnings of his permanent officials that this would provoke decades of strife. It would create profound anti-American sentiments among Arabs, and it would involve the United States in lasting support of an isolated Israel. All of that, of course, came to pass. Even though they came true, these dire predictions, Truman proved more farsighted than his diplomatic and military advisors about one thing. He could afford to ignore completely President Roosevelt's promises to Ibn Saud. The Saudi king was apparently too dependent on the United States to do anything about Truman's betrayal of Roosevelt's pledges to him. Saudi Arabia then and afterwards has remained a staunch ally, irrespective of what the United States has done on Palestine. And the United States was launched on a course, which has never really changed, of support for Israel, while paying lip service to the concerns of Arab rulers, and as much as possible ignoring the interests, concerns, and rights of the Palestinians. So this period that I've taken you back to, between 1945 and 1948, I think reveals at least two patterns in American policy over Palestine that proved to be enduring, and I will be coming back to them again and again and talking about the three moments that I'll focus on in my next three lectures. The first was a pattern of presidential pandering to domestic constituents, taking precedence over other considerations, including ordinary foreign policy concerns and sometimes the larger national interest. This pattern operated with more or less force in different administrations and under different circumstances, but it has obtained, in most cases, from Truman through Obama. This was only trumped by critical Cold War considerations in situations of crisis. We all recall examples of such Cold War considerations at work. One of them was President Eisenhower opposing Israel and its British and French allies during the Suez War in 1956 and forcing Israel to leave not only the Sinai Peninsula, but also the Gaza Strip. We all may recall another instance, President Nixon finally reining in advancing Israeli forces at the end of the 1973 war. These were rarities, however. More frequently, Cold War considerations militated in favor of strong American support for Israel against Arab states which were seen in Washington as proxies of the USSR. In fact, from the early 60s, really until the end of the Cold War in 1990, this was a major factor in American support for Israel, seeing Israel as a Cold War proxy against Soviet Cold War proxies in Syria, Egypt, and so forth. There were also a very few other cases, like the sale of American AWACS aircraft to Saudi Arabia during the Reagan administration, where powerful domestic lobbies like oil or the military-industrial complex were able to overcome the opposition of Israel and its American supporters. Otherwise, with the exception of these very few cases over 40 years, American policy on Israel and Palestine has been made essentially with an eye almost exclusively to those who, in Truman's words, are anxious for the success of Zionism. So that's the first pattern. A second pattern, at least since the time of President Truman, has been an almost complete unconcern for the fate of the Palestinians, by contrast with a consistent devotion to the welfare of Israelis. Unlike his predecessor, Truman never seems to have been much bothered about what might happen to the Palestinians. There are exchanges between Roosevelt and his permanent officials which show that this was a matter that concerned him. It wasn't just Saudi Arabia. He worried about the effect of this on the rest of the Arab world. Truman never seemed to have bothered very much about what happened to the Palestinians. He never attempted, for example, to secure for them the political and national rights like
self-determination, which had been denied them under the British mandate until 1948, or as a result of the 1948 war. He could have done this, for example, by insisting on the establishment of the Palestinian state that was envisioned by the 1947 UN partition plan, and which called for an Arab state alongside a Jewish state. Instead, both the United States and the Soviet Union, the main sponsors of this partition resolution, stood by impassively, while Israel and Jordan, with British approval and acquiescence, strangled the infant Palestinian state before birth and occupied most of its territory. The result should not be a surprise, for while the 1947 partition resolution ostensibly provided for self-determination for two peoples, that is not what happened, nor indeed was it what was meant to happen by the main sponsors of this resolution. Only one people, the Israelis, as we know, obtained self-determination. Had the United States and the Soviet Union truly desired the universal application of the principle of self-determination, they could have at least tried to see that that did happen. However, in the wake of the Holocaust, given the Cold War competition between the two superpowers that had already begun, and given the realities of American domestic politics about which Truman was so frank, the partition resolution, in fact, was primarily intended by both of its main sponsors to do exactly what it did, see to the establishment of a Jewish state. Palestinian national rights did not seriously concern policymakers in Washington or in Moscow in 1947, in 1948, or in fact for very long afterwards. As far as other rights were concerned, in summer 1948, the United States voted at the UN with a large majority in favor of General Assembly Resolution number 194, which promised the 750,000 Palestinian refugees who'd been driven or fled from their homes that they had the right to return and the right to be compensated for their losses. The United States did vote for this resolution. However, the US never made a serious effort thereafter to see to the implementation of this crucially important resolution, or for that matter, to demand Israel's withdrawal from the territories that had been allotted to the Palestinian state under the partition plan and that Israeli troops had occupied in 1948-49. In this, as in so much else, Truman established a precedent which is held to this day, a precedent of occasional declaratory positions that are ostensibly favorable to the Palestinians, combined with active policies strongly supportive of Israel. I want to give one last example of such policies, and this was the tripartite American-British-French Declaration of 1950, which ostensibly blocked arms transfers to any countries of the region. Seems like a worthy objective, preventing an arms race in the Middle East after the First Arab-Israeli War. However, by consecrating the military superiority Israel had established on the battlefield during that war, and by not preventing the subsequent secret British and French, or French and British arms shipments, not to speak of the surreptitious transfer of French nuclear technology, which enabled Israel subsequently to develop nuclear weapons, the Tripartite Declaration and through it, American policy, ensured Israel's massive long-term military advantage over the Arabs. This is a policy which the United States has pursued down to the present day, and in fact, the president made it a centerpiece of his recent speech to AIPAC about 2 weeks ago, that the United States would support Israeli military superiority over all of its neighbors. This distorted set of American priorities, which is largely directed at catering to the demands of Israel and of its vocal American supporters, rather than doing anything substantial to resolve the conflict over Palestine, has contributed significantly to a broad range of intractable outcomes. What I'm saying here is the United States is not just a bystander. The United States has significantly participated, actively participated, in creating outcomes. Now, most of these outcomes we would tend to see as the result of Israeli actions. But if you look carefully, I think it can be argued that these are a result of American policy as well. If we look at the situation in Palestine today, if we look at the situation in particular in the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem, we will see one of the weightiest of these outcomes has been the increase since 1990 in the Israeli settler population from under 200,000 people in 1990 to nearly 600,000, or around 600,000 today. This is the Israeli settler population of the occupied West Bank and of occupied Arab East Jerusalem. These and other facts on the ground, which were largely created since the Camp David Accords and which were reinforced since the Oslo Accords, which were the continuation of Camp David, constitute, in my view, daunting and perhaps insuperable obstacles to the prospect of a two-state solution. I would argue that these facts on the ground were intended by their Israeli planners to do just that. Settlements were established to prevent a two-state solution. If you don't stop the creation of settlements, you, in effect, bury a two-state solution. The success of the approach of these Israeli planners, which I would argue is by now a virtual certainty, in other words, I'm arguing that the two-state solution has basically been buried in the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem, the success of this approach continues to be blithely ignored by most proponents of a two-state solution. And I find this puzzling. People who still are advocates of a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, which is the stated policy of most countries in the world, the United States and France included, never will address how the establishment of such a state is possible in a situation where the dynamic, which has increased the settler population from under 200,000 to 600,000, is ongoing, and no one has any idea of how to stop that dynamic. It's not simply a question of what do you do with 600,000 settlers? What do you do with what I would call a settlement industrial complex, which encompasses not just one out of every 10 or 11 Israeli Jews, but which includes a huge sector of the Israeli economy, a very large sector of employed Israelis who work on maintenance of Israeli control over the Palestinians? How do you reverse that dynamic? How do you put that bulldozer into reverse? How do you find jobs for hundreds of thousands of Israelis whose job it is to keep control of the Palestinians? No one who talks about a two-state solution seems to me to address that basic question of, if you want to get there, how do you stop what's going on here now? In any case, many people, perceptive analysts, people like Meron Benvenisti, who cannot be accused of being an anti-Zionist, he was the former deputy mayor of Jerusalem, he's a respected Israeli figure, have been arguing for decades, since the 1970s, that the very option of a two-state solution, in fact, was systematically closed off by Israeli settlement activity long, long ago. I would argue this activity undermines the possibility of any form of real equitable peace between the dominant Israeli population and the Palestinian population that the Israeli state oppresses, whether we're talking about a one-state solution, whether we're talking about a two-state solution, or whether we're talking about any other solution. And this is an example of the outcomes that I would argue American policy is at least in part responsible for. And I'm going to talk in some detail when I discuss the 1991-93 negotiations how this issue came up and how the United States dealt with it and why I say this is not just an outcome of Israeli policies. This is an outcome of American policies. The United States in some measure is also responsible. These and other cold hard realities of the actual situation inside Palestine are largely screened from the American public. My lectures are not going to be about the media. My lectures are not going to be about how the American public is misled over Palestine, but it is a subject worthy of discussion. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to talk about them. The American public is bombarded with dishonest and debased language about what is described constantly as progress in what is described as a peace process, and I've already talked about this. This process ostensibly involves negotiation between near equals under the impartial gaze of an honest American broker, and it's supposedly intended to create an independent Palestinian state. This is not what is actually happening. There are not near equals. The illusion that the Palestinians and the Israelis are almost at the point of an agreement, that they are more or less states or states almost in being, is in fact a cruel illusion. There's a power that occupies and has all the panoply of control and discipline of a state, and there is a party that is a subsidiary to that, that is completely under the control of that state. They're not equal parties. And as we're going to see, the United States is not an honest broker. And as we're going to see, this is not a process that's intended to create an independent Palestinian state. This corrupt language, in fact, disguises the continuation of dependence, occupation, and colonization in Palestine. I'm going to try and show how this terminological dishonesty developed via
exploring in my next lecture, in particular, the first of these three revealing episodes, which took place after the Camp David Accords and in the lead up to the Reagan Plan of 1982. In my third lecture, I'm going to go, as I've said, I'm going to discuss the 1991-93 negotiations in Washington, which I participated. And in the final lecture, I will discuss the experience of the past 3 years under Barack Obama. What I hope to leave you with at the end of these four lectures is a sense of precisely how the United States has actually operated. I will be quoting for you remarks made in confidence by American diplomats. I will be quoting for you exchanges with Israelis. I will be quoting for you exchanges with Palestinians. I will be offering you documents which were presented to the Palestinians in the negotiations I participated in, that were presented to Israel by the United States. And I will try and show you exactly how the United States operated. And what I hope to leave you with is a sense that this was not in the manner of an honest broker. This was rather in the manner of a party that was acting, in the words of one of the American officials involved, Aaron David Miller, as Israel's lawyer. This is a term which, in fact, goes back to Henry Kissinger, who first used that term for the United States. But it was apparently frequently used by the individuals, Dennis Ross, Aaron David Miller, Daniel Kurtzer, and others who worked on this issue over the past 30 years. And I will argue that the United States, in serving as Israel's lawyer, served neither the long-term United States national interest nor the real interests of the peoples of the region, including the Israelis, and did not serve the interests of international peace and stability. Thank you very much.